This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Ambassador Steve Pfeiffer, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute, a former ambassador to the Ukraine, spent a lot of time on the NSC. Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So obviously, you know, you're a very well-known expert on arms control, nuclear weapons, so I think that's probably a good place to start today. When you look out at the world from that perspective of arms control, what do you see?
Well, you see a process that has not made as much progress as we were hoping, say, back in 2009 after President Obama gave his speech in Prague where he talked about the goal of ultimately eliminating nuclear weapons, although he made clear that as long as nuclear weapons exist, the United States would have to maintain a robust deterrent. You had the negotiation in the conclusion in 2010 of the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty. That's now being implemented. It'll bring U.S. and Russian strategic forces in 2018 down to 1,550 deployed strategic warheads. And that was seen as a modest gain, but important in terms because it does have data exchanges and various verification measures. But what happened to arms control after the New START Treaty was it didn't go further in terms of nuclear reductions. President Obama made very clear already in 2010 that he wanted to go on to a next stage that would further reduce strategic nuclear forces, but would also bring in non-strategic nuclear weapons and open up the possibility that for the first time, Washington and Moscow would be negotiating on all of their nuclear weapons. But the Russians didn't seem to be interested in going further. They instead raised connections to things like missile defense, long-range conventional weapons in a way that pretty much locked up any further progress. So we haven't moved much beyond the New START Treaty from 2010.
And why do you think that is? Do you think, I mean, obviously our relationship with Russia was different in 2009, 2010 than it is now in 2016. So we can't blame the current state of affairs as the only reason we haven't made more progress. Certainly that may be a part of it, but why do you think we are where we are?
Yeah. Well, certainly the relationship in the last couple of years since Russian aggression against Ukraine with the seizure of Crimea, that relationship has fallen to its lowest point since the end of the Cold War.
Right.
But the arms control process was stuck even before that. By 2011, 2012, it didn't seem like further progress on nuclear reductions was going to be possible in the short term. And there are a couple of reasons. We're trying to figure out why. I mean, one is, I think on the Russian side, there may be reasons for keeping more nuclear weapons than we would think that they need that are related to, for example, national prestige. It's pretty clear that Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin seek to portray Russia as a superpower. But when you look at Russia's assets in hard terms, really the only claim that Russia has to superpower status is having a large nuclear arsenal. A second factor is that although Russia has been, in the last 5 or 7 years, modernizing its conventional forces, there still are probably significant gaps between American and NATO conventional forces and Russian conventional forces. So the Russians may see a greater need to rely on nuclear weapons to balance out those disadvantages. What the Russians have been saying, going back to 2011, is that they can't make further progress on nuclear reductions or negotiate for the nuclear reductions until the United States addresses other issues, including missile defense. The Russians express a lot of concern about that. Long-range conventional weapons. The Russians are talking now about bringing third countries into the negotiations, although it's very hard to see how that would happen.
You mentioned the word modernization. It comes up a lot when we talk about nuclear weapons. So do you think that we're moving along at the pace we should be, you know, the United States, in our modernization? What is the role of modernization in arms control?
Well, when you look at American strategic forces, we have a lot of systems that are aging. You know, submarines that have been at sea for close to 30 years now, the B-52, which has been flying since the 1960s. So I believe a certain modernization program makes sense. We do need to replace the ballistic missile submarines. That tends to be seen as the most secure element of the American deterrent.
Sure.
And the existing submarines, they'll start to be retired at the end of the 2020s. The Air Force would like to build a new penetrating bomber. They also want to build a new long-range standoff option weapon, a cruise missile. That's an area where I'm not sure that they've made a good case, because when they talk about the new penetrating bomber, the B-21, it'll have stealth features, it'll have advanced electronic warfare capabilities, mm-hmm. so that presumably it can deal with and get through an adversary's sophisticated air defenses. In that case, it's not going to be why you then need a cruise missile.
But
it gets down to, if you build a cruise missile, we built a cruise missile back in the 1970s
right.
because the B-52 bomber was a big target on somebody's radar screen, and sure. we understood the B-52 couldn't penetrate. Well, if the B-21 will be able to penetrate, we don't need the cruise missile. Now, if we conclude that the B-21 maybe is not going to be so stealthy and can penetrate, I'd argue maybe scrap the B-21 program, which is set to cost $60 to $100 billion, mm-hmm. maybe build the new cruise missile and put it on, say, modified Boeing 767s. When I look at the modernization problem, a lot of the pieces make sense. Mm-hmm. There are some pieces, the long-range standoff option, that I don't think the Pentagon has made a good case for. And also I'd question whether all of the numbers that we are talking about make sense and whether we'll be able to afford it.
So when you kind of analyze an argument for whether modernization or reducing nuclear weapons, increasing, how do you go about doing that? What do you look for and say, are we making a strong case? Are we not? What are the kind of those key points?
Yeah. Well, I would start from the premise that again, I think for the foreseeable future, I would like to see us get to a world without nuclear weapons.
Sure.
I think it's going to be very hard to do so.
Sure.
and so I think for the foreseeable future, we are going to have to maintain a robust deterrent, and I think it makes sense to maintain a triad, mm-hmm. ballistic missile submarines, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and bombers. But I do question the numbers, and I guess what mm-hmm. I'd like to see us do is, using a combination of modernization mm-hmm. and also arms control,
sure.
is to move to a modern force as we replace old systems, but move to smaller numbers. And ideally, if we could get the Russians on the same track, we could bring the numbers down even as we replace aging systems. And there may be something here. It's hard to be optimistic about prospects for further nuclear negotiated reductions with Russia in the near term, but there are some indications that the Russians may be encountering some of the problems that I think we will encounter, which is budget difficulties. That
sure.
this stuff is expensive and we can't afford it. And maybe that'll give both sides an additional incentive to look back at the arms control track and see if we could get to a negotiation that would bring us to lower numbers.
So with that perspective in mind, do you think, we'll be around for there to be a day for the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty to come back? And Secretary mm-hmm. Kerry posed that question about a year ago at the 20th anniversary, and which I was lucky enough to be sitting in the audience, and then he asked how old I was and if I was alive when the treaty came together. But do you think we will be alive for ratification?
I hope so, because I think the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is very much in the U.S. interest. When the treaty was first considered by the Senate for ratification in 1999, it didn't secure consent to ratification. But that was because of two reasons. One, the Senate said, how can we be sure that we can have confidence in the reliability of nuclear weapons if we can't test the arsenal? And how do we know that somebody won't cheat? And those were really good questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answers in 1999 may not have been that good. But in the last 17 years, we've got very good answers. So we now have more than 20 years' experience with the Stockpile Stewardship Program.
That's right.
Where you have the directors of all the national nuclear laboratories and the commander of Strategic Command each year now certify that they're confident in the reliability of the arsenal based on means that do not require nuclear testing. And the lab directors have basically said as long as they have the funding for the Stockpile Stewardship Program, they don't see a need for us ever to resume testing.
Right.
In terms of verification, the verification means have become much better. And even just using the international system, there's an international monitoring system that has almost 300 stations around the world that's separate from the American unilateral
yeah.
system. But that system, I think, can detect a nuclear test anywhere down to 1 kiloton, and in some geologies down to a fraction of a kiloton.
Wow.
So I think we've reached the point now where we could say, because most beginning nuclear powers are going to test something that will be larger than a kiloton, that we could detect an illicit test. And I'd add the two other reasons. One is it's been more than 24, 25 years since we've tested in Nevada. Las Vegas is about 50 miles from the Nevada nuclear test site. We used to call the test site. It's now the Nevada National Security Site.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody think that Las Vegas, which now has triple the population it did when the last test was conducted in 1992, is going to say, yes, we want to resume testing. Remember how hard Nevada fought against storage of nuclear waste there.
Right.
So politically, I don't think it's going to be possible. And the last reason I would add is when you look at the number of tests that were conducted, and U.S. tests, because of things, we used very, very large diameter tunnels so we could have lots of space to place instruments. We probably gathered more information than anybody else in the world about nuclear tests. Why would we not want to ratify this treaty, bring it into force, and lock in an American advantage?
Exactly. So
this seems to be a no-brainer.
So while we may not be testing, and other nations that have ratified the treaty are not, there are nations out there that are testing or claim to be testing. Do you think there's a real true threat there?
Well, I think there is a threat from North Korea. I mean, it is the one country that has tested since 1998. Everybody else has really observed a self-imposed moratorium, and that's important. And I think North Korea is a special case. I mean, the level of North Korea, they've done 3-4 tests now. They're getting more information, but they're still, I think, at a relatively beginning stage. There, I think, is going to have to be a different effort to address the North Korean problem, and that is, how do you get some kind of handle on North Korea's nuclear program? And to my mind, that's going to require a more active position by the Chinese, in that if you look at, for example, at North Korean trade, 70% of that goes to China.
Right.
The Chinese would have the ability to really significantly increase the pressure on North Korea. That might bring the North Koreans to a different approach. I think the problem that we have is the Chinese, I don't think the Chinese like it, having a nuclear North Korea as a neighbor.
Right.
The Chinese fear is that if North Korea comes under too much pressure, it collapses, it then reunifies with South Korea, and then China faces a unified Korea with American troops allied to the United States on its border. So I wonder if there'd be a way to talk to the Chinese and basically look, in that kind of situation, you know, even if there was reunification, you're not going to have American forces move towards China. And in fact, you could even make the argument that with the North Korean regime gone, the requirement for American troops in South Korea would be less.
Significantly
but
less.
But we may need to think, wait, is there some way that we can address that Chinese concern to get them to see that the real problem here, the real threat, is North Korea with, at best, an erratic leadership having nuclear weapons?
So, in your experience with the former Soviet Union, with Russia, do you think there are lessons we learned, or maybe are continuing to learn, from our conversations with them that can help us move forward with China and North Korea?
Yeah.
Or are they so different and with different motivations that it's an entirely different ballgame?
Yeah. I would separate North Korea, with, I think, is a special case, from China. And I believe that one of the things that we learned from nuclear weapons discussions and arms negotiations with, well, first the Soviet Union and Russia that go back to the late 1960s, is just talking actually is useful.
Right.
And there have been efforts by the Obama administration, so far they haven't been as successful as one might like, to engage China in a strategic dialogue, to talk about things like, you know, what's your concept for nuclear weapons? What sorts of plans do you have for the future? And just having that dialogue gets to a point, even if at the end of the day it may not produce a specific agreement, helps the side have a better understanding of what the other side intends to do, maybe helps the side see that the other's plans are not as threatening as it might have worried about, and creates the ability then to have a dialogue where people begin to understand terms the same way. So, for example, now, if you talk to an American arms control expert or a Russian arms control expert, and say strategic stability, both have a pretty common understanding of what that means.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure we're yet at that point between the United States and China, and getting to that point I think would be useful for a variety of reasons.
How do you think we get to that point? I mean, I wouldn't ask you to give a completely detailed playbook, but what do you think the first step on that path is?
Well, one might be, it's clear, for example, that the Chinese are concerned about American developments with regards to missile defense. And they've become concerned about the possible deployment of a THAAD missile defense battery to South Korea. Now, that battery would only have capabilities against a North Korean ballistic missile, but it puts a capability close to China. So would there be a way to engage the Chinese on that and explain the thinking behind that? Because what we don't want to have is we don't want to have China falsely believe that that capability is oriented against Chinese capabilities. What I would hate to see is American missile defense plans lead to a situation where China felt they would have to increase the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles that could reach the United States for fear that our missile defenses might be able to deal with them. Now, mm-hmm. I look at what we deploy, for example, in Alaska and California. The plan is by 2018 to have 44 missile defense or ground-based interceptors. I don't think those pose a serious threat to the Chinese capability. But some kind of a dialogue on missile defense might be useful, because to the extent that we could assure the Chinese that those missile interceptors are about North Korea and perhaps later about Iran and not about China, maybe we remove some of the incentive that the Chinese might have to build additional nuclear weapons that could target the United States.
So you mentioned Iran. Yeah. There's a lot of conversation about Iran these days, and not just because of JCPOA, but because we are coming up on an election. And it's an incredibly divisive story, for lack of a better phrase. And, you know, from my perspective, it's having a treaty does not rule out military action. Yeah. So curious your thoughts on that, and also what the role of the military is in arms control. And that's not to say, you know, use of force, but the military has other capabilities.
Yeah.
So is there a way for diplomacy and military capabilities to work together for arms control in Iran and elsewhere?
No, I think actually you saw in the run-up to the deal with Iran a combination of military and diplomacy, is that there were the negotiations being conducted by the five permanent members of the Security Council in Germany with Iran, and that was the diplomatic effort, which ultimately proved successful.
Right.
But there was always in the background lurking the possibility that, you know, if the negotiations broke down and Iran moved towards a nuclear weapons program, that the United States might have used force. Now, I personally think that that would have been a mistake,
mm-hmm.
you know, but there was always that specter in the minds of the Iranians, and that may have given them an additional incentive to conclude an agreement. And so far, it looks like the agreement is holding up fairly well. The Iranians, they have reduced their stock of low-enriched uranium. They've shipped out the excess as they agreed to do. They have shut down part of their facilities for producing additional low-enriched uranium. They're beginning the process of converting the reactor that we're concerned might produce plutonium. So I think this is, so far, it's a good news story. And while Iran is still controversial in the United States, if Iran continues to implement the agreement, when we get to the next administration, you know, it would seem to me that walking away from that agreement, you know, after a year and a half of good implementation, you know, would be a real mistake. It would be something that the United States would do unilaterally. My guess is we would not be able to persuade our European allies to restore the sanctions, and we might end up in a situation where the United States is blamed for the collapse of the agreement. The restrictions, the sanctions come off of Iran, and Iran's free to go ahead and do it at once. That doesn't seem to me like a productive American policy.
So there is a significant portion of U.S. capabilities, whether it be diplomatic, military, research, devoted to nuclear weapons, to arms control. So let's say for a minute that we do reach, you know, global zero. How would you like to see these resources redirected, and, you know, the role of the national labs in not just security, perhaps, but in the national conversation?
Yeah. Well, I think getting to global zero, and I think global zero makes sense from the point of view of the United States.
Right.
For a couple of reasons. Geography. You know, we have friendly neighbors in Canada and Mexico.
Sure.
We have the protection afforded by the Pacific Atlantic Oceans.
Big oceans, yeah.
A bad guy has to come a long way to get us.
Absolutely.
Moreover, we have, when you look at it, the most advanced conventional force capabilities in the world. So it seems to me that from a security aspect, and eliminating that risk of nuclear war is a big one for me, because you can look back and say, yes, nuclear deterrence worked between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but at several points we got really, really lucky.
Yep.
And had we had bad luck, the results would have been catastrophic.
Absolutely.
For the United States, the Soviet Union, and the world.
Absolutely.
So the question is, are we prepared to bet that we're going to be lucky forever?
Right.
But getting there is going to be hard. I mean, and this is where I think there's a role right now for the national labs to play, is you're not going to be able to get to a true zero without having far more intensive verification measures than we have now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to require a lot of willingness to accept intrusive verification, but we're going to need more capabilities. And I think already some of the labs at Los Alamos, Sandia, at Livermore, they're beginning to do some of this work. How can you, if you go beyond the current arms control regime, which limits deployed strategic warheads because they're sitting on intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine launched ballistic missiles, which are pretty easy to find when you're in a port or you're in a military base, how could you move, for example, if you were going to talk about limiting non-strategic nuclear weapons, how could you move to monitor or verify the count of a number of nuclear weapons at a site where mm-hmm. they're sitting in bunkers, things like that? And then the farther you go, as the numbers come down, the more intrusive the verification measures are going to need to be. I mean, today, when you're talking about a treaty that says the United States and Soviet Union can each have 1,550 deployed strategic weapons, if there's some cheating by a couple hundred, it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
If you're getting down towards zero, cheating with 30 or 40 could be a real game changer.
Deal, yeah.
So I think there's a lot of work that can be done in terms of thinking of new and innovative ways to verify the absence of nuclear weapons, and that's going to be an absolute precondition for moving to a world without nuclear weapons.
So, Ambassador, I'm going to ask you our last question that we ask everyone who comes on our podcast, and that's, what's next? 20 years from now, whether we do it right or we do it wrong, what does the world look like?
Okay. Well, it's hard to see right now reason for optimism in terms of dramatic new reductions negotiated between Washington and Moscow. But I do have, I think, one hopeful sign. My guess is that when it gets to 2019 or so, the Russians will want to re-engage in terms of the New START Treaty, which expires in 2021. Now,
mm-hmm.
that treaty can be extended by up to 5 years by mutual agreement by the parties. I think if you're sitting in Moscow, 2021 is not a good time for strategic arms control to go away, because that's when the American modernization program is going to be cranking up.
Yep.
And my sense is that both in Washington and Moscow, even and particularly in difficult times when the relationship is having troubles on the political side, having an overall cap on strategic nuclear forces is seen in both capitals as a good thing, and especially when it's accompanied by the transparency measures, the notifications, the data exchanges, the inspections that give a lot of insight into the side's forces. So I think we have New START. Now, the question in the good news scenario is, could we go beyond that? Could mm-hmm. you get to a U.S.-Russian negotiation where they're talking about all nuclear weapons? What I would like to see as a next step would be an agreement that would cut the current U.S. and Russian arsenals in half, so bring them down to 2,000 to 2,500 total nuclear weapons, and maybe a supplement of 1,000 deployed strategic weapons on each side. That still leaves the United States and Russia each with seven times as many nuclear
right.
weapons as the nearest third country.
Or but, really, then we need to destroy ourselves,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it leaves you with, but that would be, I think, a big step in the
sure.
right direction, and then maybe in association with that, going to Britain, France, and China, and saying, look, we know we can't negotiate equal limits, so we're not going to do a treaty. But if we're going towards this number, say 2,000 nuclear weapons on each side, why don't you make a political commitment that you will not increase the number of your nuclear weapons as long as we are reducing? So begin and get them slowly into the process of nuclear reductions. And then if you could do that, then the next step then might be where you have to begin to think, okay, how could you have a more formal structure for reductions if the sides want to continue in that way? I think also to get there, we're going to probably have to think about some hard questions on missile defense, which might be soluble. We'll have to address the question of long-range precision-guided weapons,
sure.
which, again, I think also is soluble. I think there are answers to these questions. The issue is going to be, is there political will? And right now, I'm worried that there may not be the political will on the Russian side. So the good scenario is where we can overcome that, and you're actually moving towards a world in 15, 20 years where the numbers of nuclear weapons are significantly lower on both American and Russian sides, and you're beginning to bring third countries in that process. The more negative side is that we don't make much more progress in arms control. We continue to maintain large arsenals. That continues. I think there's always that risk, and the larger
sure.
number of arsenals, the larger number of weapons, the greater the risk of a mistake, of our luck running out. And we end up spending resources that we could use much more effectively to address other problems. And that's not just an American issue. That's an issue for Russia, China, Britain, France, and all of the countries. So I think there is a choice here. I hope we're smart enough to make the right choice.
Well, I'd certainly agree with you. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, Senior Fellow at Brookings, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Filch.